Hello and welcome to the Liberation Podcast, an exploration of what it means when we say our liberation is bound in each other. Through interviews and personal dialogue, we will dissect just how liberation is experienced by the individual and how in result manifests in their communities. Let's get started. Hello and welcome back to the Liberation Podcast. My name is Safara Parrott. I am your host and your guide through this experiential journey that we call the Liberation Podcast. And thank you so much for joining. For this episode, I am joined by the inspiring, intelligent, incredible, giving, generous human being that is Cole Arthur Riley. Cole is a writer, liturgist, and speaker seeking a deeply contemplative life marked by embodiment and emotion. She's the founder and writer of Black Liturgies, which you can find on Instagram linked below, a project seeking to integrate concepts of dignity, lament, rage, justice, rest, and liberation within the practice of written prayer. Cole currently serves as the Content and Spiritual Formations Manager for the Center of Christian Studies at Cornell University. In her work, she produces and curates content to guide others into deeper musing and embodiment of the faith. At present, Cole is concerned with topics of dignity, lament, belonging, justice, rest, and liberation. Cole is also, as I was talking to her in this conversation, working on a book with Covergent Books of the Penguin Random House Publishing. So she has a lot of stuff going on, man, and I'm very, very grateful for her taking the time out of her schedule to speak with me and to really delve into topics such as ancestral experiences of liberation, her journey kind of later in life coming into Christianity and liturgical practices, and what it looks like to dismantle white gaze and expectations in white intellectual spaces such as academia. And this was a conversation that logically I think I was really prepared for. And I was like, wow, I'm stoked. I want to talk about liturgical practices. I'm very fascinated with the kind of progression of something that's very traditional, such as liturgical prayer, but also like its ability to mold into whatever the modern day is asking for. And what, you know, I believe that even traditional prayers or written out prayers need to reflect in some way, or the way that we read them and intentionally place them in our life have to, you know, reflect onto what is being experienced in the modern day. And what Cole's doing with her work, I believe, is doing that. And so it is looking at liturgical practices through a different lens that maybe has not been widely published or widely thought of as important. And allowing spaces for people of color to, you know, pray the prayers that they need to, and even hear some words and breathing practices that they may not be aware that they needed. And Cole is doing that very important work as we speak. But like I said, I think coming into what I knew this space was going to be, or at least what I wanted our conversation to facilitate, I just don't think I emotionally connected to it very, very quickly. And I don't think I realized, you know, how I emotionally was stepping into the space and what I needed to address before coming into the space, because I try to do that before going into any of my conversations, of just like, okay, where am I emotionally sitting with this information and this research that I've done, and how can I bring at least some of that, you know, with healthy boundaries, into this conversation so that we may be able to build trust and, you know, some kind of communion in that. And I was hiding a lot from what I needed to know about my emotions coming into this conversation, and I was honest with Cole, so I sent her some key focal points that we were going to focus on in our conversation. I do that with all my guests, and we agreed on it, and it was all good. And then it was like 1 a.m. the night before our conversation, and I was just like, I wasn't feeling right about it. I wasn't feeling... It's not that the questions or key points were bad. It was more so that I knew I was holding back something. And so I rewrote them at like 3 a.m. and sent them to Cole very early in the morning. So I'm very sorry, Cole. I know you said it was okay, but I'm still apologizing now. And yeah, and I realized very late at night that I was like, okay, I've never spoken about rest the way that Cole speaks about rest. And I have never emotionally sat with this kind of level of contemplative meditation on rest, and that was really jarring to me. And I think you'll be able to hear maybe the after the halfway point of this conversation, about 30 minutes in, 25 minutes in, and I know for myself, I started to really settle into it, and I get emotional by the end when we are speaking about modern proximity to liberation. And what I mean by that is that, and we talk about this a little bit more in detail, but what we, in the modern times, we feel that our proximity to liberation is greater than those who came before us, in the sense that, you know, we have modernized technology. We have, which is kind of a redundant statement, but we have, you know, technological advances. We have more therapeutic practices to look upon. We have more, just abundant more resources. But then we kind of flip that on ourselves and saying, well, who are we to say that, first of all, liberation has a proximity point, because that is inferring that liberation is a location. And then assuming that ancestrally, and I'm aware that this technically isn't my ancestry because I am adopted, but however, Black folks in the greater diaspora in general, who are we to say that ancestrally people before us were outside of the idea of liberation, or that their storylines, regardless of how resilient and wonderful and amazing that they did to keep us all alive, who are we to say that, you know, they weren't close either, or that they had a lesser understanding of how to become liberated? And that knocked me out, man. That, like, I got emotional while we were talking, and my eyes started getting hot, and I was trying to fight back sobbing, which I did after. But, you know, I think we just cloud ourselves in thinking that, you know, surely with all of our resources, we are closer in proximity, when that, you know, isn't true. And that's kind of giving into the narrative that, you know, the slave story, or that, or, you know, this hopelessness story, that this is what our ancestors were hopeless, or truly were without, when we have no idea. But also, they got us here, you know, they got us here, and they got us to the resources. So this conversation, sorry to make it so long, this intro, but this conversation was really special to me because we really teased out what the hell liberation means for us, but also just like in honor of people before us, and in honor of, you know, liturgical, in honor of the ability of liturgical practices to broaden our worldview and bring in the language of liberation into our spiritual practices, but also into our everyday language as well, referring to we as in all struggles, or seeing people who are outside of your communities and still seeing them as we, and bringing that into your community and seeing like, oh, I wonder how this person is feeling about this going on in the world, and I want to bring them into my mind so that I have an intentionality when I connect with these people, or something like that. And so all of this to say is that I thank Cole very much for giving me this space and also sharing this conversation. You can follow Cole on Black Liturgies on Instagram. It's literally just called at Black Liturgies. You can also support Cole on Patreon. This was for her book, and to that she can just make a living in doing incredible spiritual work that's very important. So please find Black Liturgies on Patreon and become a member of them and support their work monetarily. It's very important. And also, lastly, I have a Medium post up if you would like to see that. That is going to be linked below in the show notes. Also, rate, subscribe, and follow the podcast and send it around to people. This is a special episode for me, so I don't really want to take up much time promoting that stuff. But please support Cole in the links linked below. And then also support me by sharing and following and subscribing and rating to the show. That would be wonderful. Thank you so much. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Cole Arthur Riley. Cole, thank you for being on the show. I know that you came into your Christian practice, I would qualify as like later in life. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering of what led you to seek out a religious practice? And was there something you were specifically looking for in a religious practice that was going mm-hmm. to bring you somewhere?
Oh, that's a good second question there. Yes, you were right. I wasn't raised in a religious home and would say I came into things, well, later in life for me, because I'm only 30 now. My household wasn't overtly religious. My stepmother's father, so my Zadie, was Jewish, and I was very fascinated by him as a child and growing up, and his storytelling and rituals. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't until late high school that I really began taking seriously the idea of religious practice. Until that point, I would have probably said I was agnostic. Mm. And maybe parts of that still cling to me even now. But back then I was a very immature intellectual. And I think I use my ideas of God to kind of prop up a sense of intellect, a sense of rationality, which at that point I idolized. I very much so wanted to be seen as smart and thoughtful. And so I think that's maybe why I came to embrace religion out of a lot of reading. Like, I took out books on the major world religions and creationism and absolute truth. And I made a pretty big deal out of finding a reason for God and the divine. And in hindsight, I think that's just what I needed. Like this grand intellectual quest. That's my selfhood at that time needed in order for me to begin to approach the divine. So I'm grateful for that. But I think it's become much more than that in time.
So your work with Black Liturgies, it's rooted in creating a space of dignity for Black liberation, for rest, for rage, for all of the like multiple emotions that Black people experience all the time. How does it then transition into you kind of intentionally making this space that is both for yourself and for other Black Christians, or really just for other people of color experiencing these things as well?
Mm-hmm. So I had this, the makings of that intellectual quest at the end of high school, but it really wasn't until college, I began attending a church in college, that I really began encountering other Christians and, well, talking to other Christians rather, and being in spaces where I was being taught, and I began encountering Christian doctrine. And prior to this, I had no real Christian training or formation. And so I think having that as I entered college, I think I was very fortunate because my Christian formation was coinciding with my time in the classroom where I was studying writing and literature. So I was reading Toni Morrison and Zora Neale Hurston and Richard Wright and Baldwin. And for me at that point, like church was just a part of my college experience. And so it all kind of got tangled up in each other. And I couldn't really compartmentalize what, I read of Baby Shugs in the Clearing and Toni Morrison book Beloved from what I read in Isaiah in church on Sunday. It just was really hard to untangle that from just one kind of grand experience. So in a way, just like by virtue of the timing of my Christian exploration, Black liberation and grief and peace were always kind of enmeshed in my spirituality. I can see it. I can see if I maybe would have encountered Christianity at another time, that might not have been the case. But I'm thankful that it was. But that's not to say that the Christian spaces I was in were processing those emotions and those questions with me. It was more of like, this is an independent part of my spirituality that I'm holding, but that maybe I don't feel safe to hold in a greater Christian community because at that point I was in very white Christian spaces, white conservative Christian spaces.
So I'm wondering, because you didn't grow up religious or in a really like a structural religious form like in your childhood, did you receive like what was your family's response to just like, cool, I'm super like into Christianity now, especially like having a Jewish step parent where that is like not it's not a conflict, but it's just structurally different. The practices are different, and things like that. So was there a weird like trying to find the correct word for this. Was there like an awkward reception to that?
Honestly, no. I think my parents probably thought it was a phase. So they were like,
Just going through her God phase.
saw a Bible and they're like, okay, we'll let her have this. And like, didn't really see much about who I was, like, deeply, like, shifting. But I think they were a little wary, not necessarily of me exploring Christianity, but like who, what Christian spaces, like who are these people that you're around that are teaching you? So they were wary, but very trusting and open-minded. And while neither my dad or my stepmom would say, I don't think, last I checked, would say that they believe in organized religion, they are very open and like talking about it. So they like sometimes share Black liturgies posts and
Love
they'll
that.
ask me to pray for them sometimes. And every once in a while I see them using Christian language, which I still think is kind of fascinating. Like they're kind of learning a language to hopefully communicate with me. But I'm only just beginning to realize this in the past year, but I do think that there was a my house possessed a spirituality. It just wasn't, it wasn't done in a lot of like overt language. But we had a lot of conversations and were encouraged to be aware of the beauty in everything and the beauty in ourselves and like Black dignity and the dignity of all people. And so there are a lot of concepts that I don't know, I think sometimes Christians believe are exclusive and profound only to Christianity that actually really do transcend it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like so many people ascribe spirituality to Black people a lot. And in a very almost, well, they would depict it as almost like a primal thing of like having like this overt overwhelming spirituality about them all the time. And I feel like a lot of the times I've pushed back from that because it's just like, okay, well, I didn't grow up in that kind of church or whatever. But when you're saying like your house has a specific type of spirituality to it, of appreciating the divine in everything, I also ring true to that because I feel like that's something that I do a lot. And so it's kind of just like balancing between, I would say, white expectation of your spirituality or white expectation of your ability to articulate spirituality, versus what spirituality is, which is just kind of divine in everything, or is a very free-flowing and free-formed situation.
Yeah, it's very complicated. I'm sure you've experienced this in a lot of white dominated spaces of this a lot of expectation to define things, make things clear, become clear about what you believe, or else X, Y, and Z, a lot of like doom scenarios, which, as someone, it's really difficult for me to pin down much of anything that I feel certain about. I think it would maybe frighten people to know just how loosely I hold a lot of my beliefs about God, and how often I just have to tell people I work with or students who I work with, I don't know. What do you think? And it's very disconcerting, I found, for whiteness specifically to endure uncertainty. It's just not a praxis that they've learned to embrace. And I'm not entirely sure where that fear comes from, apart from a sense of control and domination that one gets by demanding clarity and knowing where everyone stands. I don't know.
I mean, I same. I'm very, I also tend to not stand very firmly on things that I believe on or believe in. I studied a lot of existentialism when I was in undergrad. And I think I've heard you say that you were also reading some existentialism as you were coming into your Christian practice. And I think that's like, honestly, I think that to personally, and I think this is also just a Black experience thing of just like, you have, there are so many things outside of your control and so many things that are blatantly absurd, especially being Black in America, where everything about our history specifically is so absurd. All of it is absurd. And that it that I mean, if you bring that into your everyday life and into your spiritual practices, I think that in a way can be a liberating factor of just being like, okay, that means God can be anything to me. My practice can be anything to me, which is in my perception of that, that's more safe to me than having a more concrete thing that's not going to move. And I have to search for that concrete pillar in every single place in my life.
I wonder, I mean, I'd be interested to think more about like what is it in people that is it that some people need that concrete, unmovable thing in order to feel safe, whereas it sounds like you and I maybe more feel safe in the absence of the demand of like that always concrete, like unmovable thing. I think that's really interesting, and it'd be an interesting kind of experiment or I don't know, relational experiment to find out like what are those things in us that desire fluidity, and what are those things in other people that desire that whatever sense of stability they derive from the concrete.
Yeah, that is. I mean, I could think on that. I'll think about that all day, probably. But so so we're in college. We're in a predominantly white Christian practice at this moment. You're studying different Black authors, Black liberation, whilst also reading from a biblical text. And that's cool. That's awesome. I love that. Because then that becomes, you're right, like you said, it's not compartmentalized at that point, and that you can't help but see this liberation within this liberation, and that there is the intersection between the two. But I am wondering, like, when did this kind of calling to speak about rest and come and calling to speak about specifically Black liberation? Because it's one thing to just write about liberation in general. I was saying earlier, I feel like liberation, and I'm coming more into understanding this the longer I do this podcast as well, is that liberation, not only is something that doesn't have language necessarily. You can write as much as you want about the idea of liberation, but when you point at it, you can't point at something and say that's liberation or something like that. And it also isn't one grand sweeping gesture, and it's not this like magnum opus of an event. And so, but you're also pairing that idea with something that's unapologetically the Black experience. And that reminds me so much of Toni Morrison and Baldwin and Audre Lorde, where it's just, I'm not going to explain anything. I'm not going to explain who I'm speaking to or what reason I'm speaking to them for it, because it's not anyone else's business. It's not associated with you, not in an exclusionary way. I mean, technically, but more so in like, I'm gonna take care of my people kind of way. So what did that, I'm assuming if you call it a calling, but what does that kind of transition from you for you from being an early like practicing Christian, reading all these things to what you're doing now with Black liturgies?
Yeah, I mentioned I studied writing and literature, and I've always been drawn to words. I express myself most freely in written words, for sure. And when I encountered a liturgical prayer expression, when I encountered written prayer, which the first time I did was in an Episcopalian church. I was just struck by the beauty of, writing words for God. And up until that point, I really hadn't done that, unless you would count journaling or something like that, but nothing like liturgy. And so I began to attend an Episcopal church, become more interested in that kind of prayer expression, and am Episcopalian today. But I tell people it because the Episcopalian, the Anglican Book of Prayer, is called the Book of Common Prayer, mostly written by Thomas Cranmer, a white man. Most of the liturgies you wouldn't encounter in a liturgical church service would be written by white people. And I say it just becomes difficult sometimes to pray words written by white people all the time. And I was grieving the loss of a lot of back-to-back Black death at the hands of police officers. And I thought, I need Black liturgies. Like, I need a liturgical expression that feels capable of speaking to my pain, my rage, in a way that doesn't feel so isolated. I don't want to just do this alone in my bedroom anymore. And so Black Liturgies was born. And initially, the idea of rest, wasn't at the forefront of my mind when I started Black Liturgies. I was just mad. It was rage, and I'm like, but people like to think that Black liturgies was started out of like some noble desire to serve people or something. No, it started Black liturgies was born of rage. I was mad.
And real quick, I'll let you finish this thought, but isn't that, Isn't that something that's so telling? That because I mean, the aesthetics of Black liturgies is just in general just a very calming aesthetic, because it's just very like it's earth tones, white text, and whatnot. But isn't it something that a Black woman is behind something, and it's immediately thought that she's trying to take care of us, or she's trying to offer a peaceful gesture or something?
People still
Sorry, I didn't mean
get
to
that way.
interrupt, but I was just
No,
like,
it's
I just it,
true.
that happens to me as well all the time.
Yeah, it's the easiest assumption, about a Black woman's motivations. It's like she's trying to serve. That literally did not cross my mind. I had anger to release, and I did so. And maybe now that has ebbed and flowed out of a motivation of service. But I don't think, the Black liturgy's origin story is an act of service. So hopefully people listening will just accept that and be okay with it. Sorry if I've ruined your idea of me. But yeah, it took some time for me to. I knew that I wanted to talk about the body, and I wanted that to be a pattern in, or a kind of rhythm in the prayers that I was writing. But as I did that, I realized like what our bodies need as Black people so often is rest. And so a lot of my prayers that are trying to help other people ground themselves in their bodies end up being prayers about rest. It's just difficult for them not to be. And I honestly, in college, whenever I was first becoming this like truly justice-oriented person and a Christian, my ideas of liberation were rooted a lot in doing and what I could do, how I could serve. There's a lot of Christian language of service that I kind of absorbed into my daily lived experience. And it wasn't until after college that I just realized how tired I was, tired of giving and explaining and doing things. And I used to think of rest as this thing to do, as this means in order to work for justice and for liberation. And that's completely shifted in the past 5 years, where I now view it as an act of justice in and of itself, in a world where, first of all, where my ancestors were denied the right to rest when they needed to listen to their bodies and attune to them. What generational healing comes when Black people today lie down. But also in the present, where marginalized people, people of color, working themselves to the bone. Fortunately, I'm not one of them. But many of us are. And so every moment where, a Black woman rests her eyes or pauses for a moment is a kind of sacred resistance, I think.
It's interesting because I was just listening to the author of My Grandmother's Hands. What's his name?
I don't know how to pronounce his name. Rizma.
Rismah Menakem, I think. And he was talking about one of the practices that he has in the book is kind of like a spatial awareness practice for Black people, of just like if you're in your house, or if you're like in a place that you consider logically as safe, just look over your shoulder and know that no one's there to like get you, essentially. And it's like he just puts in this practice of easing the generational traumatic mind that is trained to look behind it all the time, and give it that ease that nobody's there, and that you're in a place that's logically comfortable, and to just like take a deep breath and exhale. and just like let that part of you exhale grief or exhale some kind of relief. And then like have a moment of rest if you need it or whatever. And I think that myself, being adopted, you know, I wasn't necessarily, I don't have the same generational trauma that many Black folks in the US have. However, and the trauma that does exist within my body, I'm not, I don't have a, like a paperwork to get there essentially. And so I, in the times that I have to rest, I know that it has to be both in a, I'm doing this because my present body is tired, but also I'm doing this because something that I have that is unnamed or something that doesn't have a, traceable experience or traceable, you know, tangibility to it also needs rest. And I found that there was, a couple of your liturgies, that were from last year that I read that I was just like, oh my God, like something I was very unaware of. And that's something in my body was like, we're going to go sit outside for a second and we're just gonna, we're going to live with whatever just happened.
Yeah.
And just sit. And that's really difficult to wrap your mind around, forcing yourself to rest or forcing yourself to intake whatever, just like what you just experienced, as opposed to just like, okay, that happened and that, let's just add it to the list and keep going forward.
Right. It's easy. Yeah. Movement. I tell the students who I work with that, sometimes trauma, especially racial trauma, it's like when you get hurt playing a game or like doing some sport or you trip and fall, and it's and it's not until you stop moving and you like look down and see yourself bleeding that something connects and you really are able to perceive and apprehend like this is where it hurts. And I do think that's what rest does to us, and that is why rest can be so horrifying, the prospect of really looking and seeing where it hurts, seeing where your body is crying out for healing and reattunement. It can be a painful exercise. It's, you know, undoubtedly healing as well, but it can be costly. It is a rest to risk. It's a risk to not rest.
Yeah.
But it's also a risk to rest. It definitely draws us into something.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that it's also reminding what we were talking about just a few minutes ago about this kind of difference between finding comfort in something that's concrete as opposed to something that's always moving or has the, it's opportunistic in the way that it can be fluid. And I think that rest has to do with that as well. And that to embrace fluidity is to, I mean, that is consistently to embrace uncertainty, but that's also, you're forced to kind of fully embrace what rest is calling you to do. And fluidity calls for inward looking a lot of the time, or some kind of call to connect to something that you maybe are uncomfortable with or uncomfortable vocalizing. And so it kind of, fluidity also calls us to uncomfortable situations a lot of the time. And I feel that maybe part of your work is rooted in that as well, of just like, because I feel that, granted, I don't follow a lot of liturgy accounts, and I don't have many liturgists as friends, just the one. And but I feel like the words white supremacy and then right next to liturgies doesn't happen very often. And so, and I mean, you have what? You have like 100 some odd thousand followers on there. I'm going to go ahead and assume they're not all Black. And so I feel like even in your work, even though it's not intentional,
that is still, and even for some people of color and some Black folks, it's uncomfortable to see, it's even uncomfortable to see, I don't know, like a, it's uncomfortable to see a, if you were to quote Angela Davis, that's uncomfortable to see next to something that they have compartmentalized as their spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting of like, for you, I'm assuming, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, because of how you were already reading about Black liberation at the time whilst coming into your practices, that's a kind of like that's like a no-brainer to combine the two. But I'm wondering if you have had people reach out talking about uncomfortability through your work, or talk about, you know, ways that they haven't seen spirituality presented the way that you have presented it through your work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've had a lot more positive feedback and just kind of like curious feedback than any real challenges. There have of course been people, but not many thoughtful challenging.
Oh, sure. No.
Which I'm like still kind of in awe of. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've encountered a lot of people who reach out regularly to just process feeling so confined by spirituality, specifically Christian spirituality, in the past, and feeling like, you know, something maybe has been opened up to them that they didn't feel like they could do and still be called a Christian.
Yeah.
And honestly, I see a lot of that tension in people. Like, what can I do? How much can I advocate for my own dignity before people will no longer think I'm Christian, will I no longer belong to this thing or this community that I'm in? And it's really quite tragic, honestly, that people feel so confined, feel like their belonging in Christian spaces is so at risk that if they were to believe or say a certain thing, that they would lose community, that they would lose standing in a community. I have a lot of sympathy for that. And I think not being raised in a Christian home and not having the majority of my family and the majority of my household as Christians is, I mean, people feel bad for me because of it, but honestly, in ways it has been very freeing because I can explore, I can say,
right.
And I don't have to worry. I don't have to fear, abandonment. And so I have great sympathy for a lot of Christians who follow me, who just don't yet feel like they can say things publicly that they wish they could say because so much is at risk for them.
Yeah. There are two things come to mind when you're saying that. One of them being, I remember being really young, probably, I would say maybe in junior high or high school. And like I said earlier, I wasn't specifically told on like the church's stances on this, like blank, 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 because I grew up also non-denominational. Mm-hmm. And so I've always been fully accepting of literally any presentation of how you want to live your life. I don't care. Like, I mean, I do care because I uphold it in its dignity, but like, I don't care because you do you. Like, I don't care. But obviously that's not the norm. And but I remember thinking when I was really young, I was just like, I don't understand the really, and it comes from fear, but I don't understand the desire for so much limitation on a love that you're claiming to be limitless. Mm-hmm. I don't understand the desire to white knuckle clench your perceptions of the world and reflect them onto something that you're claiming is like unworldly, is outside of our perception of the world. And I never understood that. And then I, you know, as I grew up and I'm meeting a lot of different people. One of my friends, Emily, is an author of a book that just came out about purity culture. And she was the originator for the Church Too movement. And she was saying that she was talking about, you know, progressive churches that will, they'll say, oh yeah, purity culture does uphold abuse and all of that stuff does happen. However, we still believe in some form of modesty. And so it's kind of just like, it's still giving those limits where they think it's a fear of loss. It's a fear of something going away from them, whether that be, it could be something materialistic like money, because you will lose some kind of form of donations if that's what your church is rooted in, but also you lose a community, quote unquote. And in so much of that is rooted in just deep fear, which is shocking. Like, it's just so interesting that, like, how fear plays into a lot of Western Christian practices,
mm-hmm.
and how that fear of something fluid or that fear of not having this concrete understanding. I'm just so fixated on this concrete pillar thing, but just not having this concrete understanding invokes so much fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. And fear is a good word for it. I think some mix between fear and belonging. And I think we've thought of it as like, this is just social conditioning, whatever. I think there's really something to be said about the role that belonging plays in our fear of saying what we actually believe. It operates, and I don't just mean this in like conservative spaces. I mean this in any space. To feel like you're going against is a risk, and to feel like you're going to lose connection, I think, is something that we really haven't begun to contend with, the ways that can make someone say or do things that they don't actually believe, which I'm in the process of writing a book, and I've just been thinking so much about this, like, and it's made me, I think, a more empathetic person in the world. And I'm learning I can be empathetic without making excuses, but there are things. Yeah. I see my inbox messages and I'm like, there are people who are so conflicted, not because of what they believe. They know, they know what they think.
Yeah.
They know they don't, or they know what they don't think.
Yeah.
They know that they don't actually have a stance on X, Y, and Z, but they feel like they need to have a stance, or else they won't be a part of something anymore. Like, I see so much of that and I'm like, what are we doing? You know, I'm just becoming more sensitive to that. And so for me, like, I have things that I believe in, but I believe in them not based on certainty at all. I believe in them based on, like, I'm just hoping. Like that kind of belief. Like, please let this be true of God. Like, I'm pleading with myself and the world to, like, let these things be true of God. But I'm no longer going to drag myself into, you know, stances articulations before I'm ready. And it's hard being, I don't like thinking of myself as a public voice, but I am a public voice and I need to deal with that. And it's really hard as a public facing voice to not be clear on things all the time.
Yeah. So this might have, I mean, it has the, sorry, now I have like 1,000 thought processes going on. That saying something, you saying I'm not going to say something before I'm ready is hits on so many different angles of what I feel that many young activists, young, literally anybody who's plugged into any kind of social political field, whatever that's going to be, it could be religious, it could be actually political, it could be whatever. So many people are demanded to make a statement so quickly. and they're demanded to have a thought process on something so quickly. And so much so that their audience or the people that support their work are basically already write a statement for you before you even do anything. And that alone is a incredibly bizarre thing. I've personally had people message me saying something that I've said is off message, where I'm like, you first of all don't like barely know who I am, but like but like you don't know what's off message for me or not. I think it's so interesting of what you do when you write different breath work stuff, and that and in my experience of doing breath work in my therapy or in different meditative, you know, sittings, where when you breathe and think and really allow whatever information to come in and whatever information to leave, that allows so much inner working that it does reveal to you what you need to focus on or what your actual thoughts are in regards to a situation or, you know, any kind of something that you feel is demanding your opinion on or thoughts on, or even something that you need to process privately. It's really difficult to navigate when to talk and when to speak. And I'm learning myself, that even though I am a Black woman who experiences a lot, even for myself, I don't need to speak all the time. And I know for myself, I have a podcast, but also in general, I think I just bring a specific commanding energy when I speak that I know people are going to listen regardless. And it's knowing that I'm bringing that to the table and to make sure that I don't misuse my own ability to speak.
I mean, here's a great example. So at the time of recording this, we're seeing a lot more public attention in America about the Palestinian crisis, Palestinian oppression, especially in the past few days. I've had dozens of people inbox me asking me to write a prayer for Palestine. And I really struggle because much of me wants to be the person who can articulate words. But there's a number of reasons why I'm hesitant to do that. The least of which, of course, being the fact that I'm not convinced that Christians need to necessarily center their own spirituality at this time, while acknowledging that there are Palestinian Christians. But also an American, I'm like, I don't know if I would want anyone to trust me. And I had a similar request with the Myanmar coup and those protests. And it took me weeks to write a liturgy for Myanmar. And I only was able to do it because I gained a friend who was actually in it and could teach me a lot of things. But the past few days I've been thinking, like, I don't think I'm the voice that really needs to be heard in this. I can post resources and point to other voices that need to be heard. And I can't remember who said this. It's not original to me, but I heard someone say once, I believe a Black woman, that when we rest, we give opportunities to other people. Like, my rest is someone else's opportunity. And I think there's something really beautiful about mutuality, about solidarity. There's a lot of lessons in that statement of like, it's actually could be good for me to not center a Black liturgies post and have a bunch of people reposting it. But how can I lift up someone else's voice right. in this season. Yeah. And so I did actually write a prayer. And I don't know if I'll post it or not. If I do, it wouldn't be for a few weeks probably, but I wrote a breath prayer. And I've just been doing that by myself. And like, is that no less beautiful? Is that no less powerful because it's solitary? I hope not, you know? It's a response, even if it's not always public.
Yeah. Oh man. I think that that is also very, there's a connection there between what I was saying. Well, when I interrupted you and saying that, you know, people's assumption that, that Black liturgy started as a service, and how demanding a statement from somebody is also demanding a service, because then you're also, in my perception of, you know, internet culture in that way, that is waiting for somebody to say something is them waiting to hear the validation of how they get to feel. And it kind of harks back to what you were saying about people really knowing how they feel about something or what they do or do not believe in, but being afraid to vocalize that or being afraid to speak against something. And that just felt like that a connecting piece there of just waiting for someone's response is basically like misaligning the power structure there, where it's disproportionately putting so much power. I don't want to power that is non-consensual, I guess I would say, onto you, and then them inadvertently making themselves powerless in their decision making or powerless in their belief systems.
It's so funny that you say that. It's funny that you say that because I wouldn't have articulated that dynamic and that powerlessness. But with one of the women who asked was Black, and I just tend to respond to those DMs more. And so I responded to her and I was like, I would love to hear a prayer that you would write for Palestine. And we've actually been going back and forth, and I don't know if she'll write one and share it with me, but I think that would be a really beautiful turn of events, you know, to see her like, you can step into this. I would love to hear, like, what kind of things would you say? Like, what would you say to God about what's happening?
Yeah. Cause I feel like people are kind of afraid to be ugly to God too. And present hatred to him or to them, however you want to think about who God is. And people are really again, it's that fear of not belonging and that general fear of just like being abandoned or being misunderstood or whatever key functions that human beings need from something will be lost if their uncertainty is vocalized. Which is also something that I struggle with in my personal life. This whole conversation is just like, hey, let me tell me that you're in therapy without actually saying you're in therapy, which is just a podcast. But I it's just, oh wow. I've never really thought about the power structures between these things ever. And now I'm so intrigued.
That is someone's future dissertation. Power on social media specifically, I think would be really interesting and complicated.
So the last thing I want to ask you about is, you know, this it kind of pulls into power structures and ideas of power structures, but I'm wondering, like, how do you process, and you don't have to talk about your process soap too personally if you don't want to, because that is a very private thing for you, or it should be for anybody, but how do you process, you know, the white gaze within your work, and how do you, because you also work within academia as well. And academia is predominantly white gazed, created by, some form of white superiority in intellectualism. Mm-hmm. How do you navigate that space, and how do you, you know, how do you process? I'm going to assume that people, because I don't think it's too far of a stretch to assume that white people have reached out to you to ask if they could use your prayers or to present your prayers in some classroom or a Bible study or something. Mm-hmm. How do you process that?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I have complicated feelings about
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
I think I truly was naive about the amount of white people who would want to follow an account called Black Liturgies. I wasn't really active on social media before Black Liturgies. People are always like, I can't find anything out about you before Black Liturgies. I really wasn't very active and was definitely not in this realm of like justed oriented social media accounts.
Yeah.
And so there's just so much that was a learning curve for me. And I think whiteness on social media being one of them, I was just like, why would you follow me? Confused.
Which also just gestures to Black culture everywhere. Why are you participating? Interesting.
Why do you want this? But I think that part of it is, or it has the potential to be really beautiful. And I do have a lot of white people who ask me, like, is it okay that I'm in this space? And I say, ask yourself some questions about how, like, if is it, can you, I don't know you, are you able to be in this space without centering yourself in this space? Are you able to be in this space and pray these prayers knowing that, I mean, some of it might resonate with you, but a lot of it probably won't resonate to you. And you might not understand what I'm saying at times. And like, are you able to not have things explained to you? And I don't say all that.
Which also that just like the question, can I be in this space, is a form of centering yourself already, because you're asking a Black woman if she'll allow you to be in this space, and you're already exercising. And I know I get the intention behind it, and that's perfectly fine. But recognize that silence here would have been just as fine. And you can ask yourself those questions without saying anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think white people, especially those who are like coming into their own racial understanding, they just need a lot of interior exploration and interior work. And I think they're looking for someone on the outside to tell them. And so I try to just pose that question back to people when they ask me, like, I honestly don't know if you can be in this space. Like, here's what this space is. And then you tell me if it's going to be a space that's helpful and good for you. And I hope, I mean, I have wondered, like, is there not something mysteriously healing when something mysterious as in like outside of our comprehension and like, I don't really know, that happens when a white person prays prayers written by a Black woman? Like, does that shift things in the sacred? Does that shift things and make the sacred and Christianity more whole? And it's not necessarily, I mean, not necessarily, it wasn't at all my goal.
Yeah, sure.
But I think it's beautiful if and when that can happen, and when white people can hold Black prayers and take them just as seriously as their own.
Yeah.
With that said, I'm thankful to have a lot of white people who understand, like, I'm not going to reply and engage with you in the same way, just because I have such a limited... Yeah. I have a full-time job. I have a limited amount of time that I can devote to like being in this community and engaging.
Yeah.
And so when I have the time, I try to engage and center Black people in my DMs and center emails and those things and messages from Black organizations and Black people. And I haven't gotten too much flack for that. I've said it on a few podcasts now, and like, no one's ever said anything to me about it. But I think like white people just have to come and understand, like, you're not going to be the main attraction. Like, maybe I wrote a prayer about anxiety and you might have anxiety and can find some resonance in that prayer. I think that's beautiful. But as you pray it, are you able to think, like, what does anxiety mean for a Black woman? Like, what does, or there's
see, a prior- that's sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
It's okay.
That's when you first said, you know, is there some kind of divine beauty in a white person being able to uphold Black prayer? And my immediate bodily reaction to that was no. No, there is not. And I'm not going to say that I fully resolved that in the 30 seconds you continued to talk, but I will say that, right, there's a lot that goes into that alone, just that thought process of allowing white people to have our words. And, you know, there's a big trust gap that's in between the two. Because you know, how many times has Black culture or Black words, or ever been silenced? I mean, words were literally taken away from us at some point, for hundreds of years. Words were made illegal to us, essentially. And so, you know, Black, whether it's Black liturgy or, you know, if it's something like a Toni Morrison book, if Beloved, you know, is read in a white woman's book club, it's not, that shit's going to hit different. Like, it's not going to be the same thing. And it, but when you said, if they keep it in the mindset of how does blank feel for a Black woman or for the Black, for Black people, for the people that this prayer was written for, that's the game changer, right? Because they're including that intersectional justice into what they have compartmentalized as their spirituality.
I mean, I think I'm biased because I'm a liturgist, but I think liturgy plays a really fascinating and a really fascinating role here. You know, most liturgies, nearly all liturgies, have we us language,
right?
And, like sometimes you read a line and you think like, yeah, like that's for me, I get it. And then sometimes you read a line and you're like, I don't, what? Like, I don't know what that is.
Yeah,
like, I don't
100%.
That's not me.
Sure.
But I'm committed to staying in these words on account of those who do. And I think liturgy can be, if done rightly, it can be a really profound,
that's really beautiful,
dance of solidarity, you know, of spoken language. But yeah, of course there's always risks of colonization and theft and all kinds of things, but I think there's a lot of potential for solidarity.
So the last thing that I want to ask you, is how has your, or has your idea of liberation changed over, you know, the last roughly year of doing Black liturgies, and having to write these prayers about Black death or about, you know, a pandemic, about rest, about all these things, and now I guess writing a book, like, has your ideas of all of these, you know, core emotions that you were writing about in the beginning, have these ideas changed for you in any way?
Absolutely. The last chapter and in my book is liberation. That's the title of the chapter. And it's forced me to really come to see and explore what I actually think. And I think maybe prior to this year, I had viewed liberation as this like gradual thing that is accrued. And I'm much more realizing it as something that's not linear. And something that's not, exclusive to certain times or policies. Of course, you know, good policy can help with a person's liberation,
sure,
and could lead to a form of it. But I've been thinking a lot about my ancestors in writing this book. I write a lot about my grandma, and so it's just drawing me into the past. Mm. And I think prior to this year, I kind of thought of liberation a bit arrogantly, as if I had more access to a liberated life.
Mm.
And I want to believe that even in chains, my ancestors possessed a form of liberation. Mm. And were able to have these moments of resistance and of rest.
Mm-hmm.
These movements toward liberation and belonging, even then, and that I don't have more than them. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes sense or if I'm able to articulate why
does.
That matters to me so much in this season, but it just does, you know.
Man, and that, ooh, that almost like makes me emotional, or it does make me emotional because my eyes are getting hot. I'm just thinking about, because I feel like the, you know, the slave story, even in the way that we can, that Black people retell it, is generally just very hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
But the unbelievable, like undeniable, sense of worth that I think, I mean, it's undeniable in Black people that were involved in enslavement and chattel slavery, because they went on to create things that has now led us here.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they built communities for themselves. They did all these things, and people that didn't have an understanding of minute experiences of liberation couldn't have done that.
Mm.
And that,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's just no other way other than finding liberation in just breath, or,
yep,
or just the rubbing of hands or something of that, mm-hmm, of that nature, of just some level of a whisper of self-care in that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oof. Okay. I can't talk about it anymore. I'm going to cry before I go to work. Well, thank you, Cole, so much, for just everything that you do, and the space that you've created for so many people, myself included. And yeah, just thank you for sharing your story, and sharing your thoughts and, you know, practices within the world. I think that's really special and has edified me quite a bit, given me many things to think about throughout the week, which is great.
Mm. Well, thanks for having me. It was really, really good. Good to talk this morning.
Yeah.
All right, let's just right. Okay, I know this is the second time I've had to do a little exhale at the end of a conversation, but I think that's warranted. Thank you so much to Cole. I truly could not thank you enough, thank her enough, for the work that she does with Black liturgies, with the space that we were able to facilitate for each other in this conversation, for the constant exploration that she does with her work in just, you know, seeking both contemplative works to join in with her liturgical practice, but also just like exploring what power structures mean, exploring what different elements of the world affect spiritual practices. And I think that's really cool, and to never stop, you know, asking questions about what affects me spiritually, what affects us, our worldviews, what affects our views of the people around us and the communities around us. So thank you so much, Cole, for that. If you want to support Cole's work. She has a Patreon linked below for Black Liturgies. Also follow their Instagram account, also under Black Liturgies. Cole's a pretty private person, isn't really, you know, alive on social media outside of that. So, you know, respect that space as well. If you would like to follow and subscribe to the show, do that, please. That would be wonderful. That helps me out with visibility. Also, check out different things that I have posted on the website, i.e. my Medium page, different artworks and things like that. Always check the website to see what's going on in that realm. I kind of don't have any other words besides thank you. And I will catch you all next time.